Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life science sector. As usual, we cover topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries, and we aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize the ways in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. So today's episode is one we have been waiting to do for a while because it sits right at the intersection of quality, risk, and reality. We're talking human reliability and human factors in pharmaceutical manufacturing quality. And I'm really excited to hear what this month's guests have to share because I'm seeing a pattern here. Organizations have been trying to tech their way out of human performance issues. We'll automate it. We'll add the AI review. But the risks just don't disappear. It just moves. And humans still have to make sense of all that messy world with the tech on top. And we all know the phrase human error gets used like a full stop. So as if that's the fundamental reason why something has gone wrong. But if you've ever worked in, frontline role in a plant, a lab, a warehouse, you'll know that most days don't go right or do go right because people are constantly adapting quietly and competently. They're adjusting their behaviours to fit the systems. So I'm interested in the topic. And who are your guests, Val, this week?
Hi, Nuala. And this was a very interesting conversation, as you say, with two people who've done a lot of work in this space. And I'm going to share their full bios because they're long and lengthy in the show notes. But in brief, I sat down to chat with Julie Avery. Julie has a pharma management background, has worked in OPEX, Six Sigma, but I think most of us know her for her work in the area of human reliability, human factors, and human performance quality. She's a trustee of the Chartered Institute of Ergonomic and Human Factors, which is a UK-based professional society for human factor specialists and ergonomists, I suppose you call them, anybody involved in user-centered human design. And joining us in the conversation was Dominic Furness from the Human Reliability Associates. Dominic has worked across a number of high reliability industries, oil, gas, mining, healthcare as well. And he has designed and implemented models to improve human performance and reduce the risk of human error. Anyway, the reason I invited them onto the pod is that I came across an article they wrote together, and I can only describe it as a call to action for pharma. In it, they proposed and outlined a very practical and structured approach for integrating human factor design into our PQS, into our operations, and into our risk management system in a way that's not just cultural, but auditable as well. And that for me was the key distinction. You know, I've seen, and I'm sure you have, Nuala, as well, we've seen HOP rolled out, human and organizational performance initiatives, and they're gaining, this approach is gaining traction in pharma. That's really good. It brings all the things we talk about on this pod, humility, curiosity, learning teams, psychological safety. But Julie and Dom, on top of that, are making the case that we also need the engineering rigor, the engineering toolkit to be able to analyze tasks, to identify performance influencing factors, to be proactive and identify those error likely situations and integrate those in how we do risk and how we do investigations. You know, we're a high risk industry, and I'm guessing soft approaches alone will not deliver an auditable outcome. So let's listen to what they had to say. Well, welcome to you both. Let me start by asking you, When people hear human reliability, I think what pops into their head is training or human error. And I suppose I'd like to ask you guys up front, what do you want the listeners to understand about that term human reliability before we even start talking about it?
Yeah. Thank you, Val. That is a really good question, and we do get asked it a lot of times. I would say to you that people interchangeably say human error and human reliability, or they'll say human factor errors and any sort of combination thereof. And I think what we're looking for here is when we think about human reliability, it's not just about fixing our ideas and our thoughts about people, it's about designing for people. So stop looking at the problems and the mistakes they make and start to think about how we can make their lives easier, make it easier to do the right thing and harder to do the wrong thing. So we're really flipping with human reliability. We're flipping the whole idea on its head. We're thinking, instead of focusing on who got it wrong, we're starting to think about why it made sense to do what they did at the time. And indeed, how does it normally go right? What were the pressures? What were the cues? How was the work interfaces, the screens that they were using? How does that give them choices to make, or even goals that they feel they need to achieve in that moment? It's all about the moment. So we've got a way of looking at it. We call it the first and second story. The first story is obvious. It's the mistakes that people make. And of course, they do contribute to some of the deviations and incidents that we see. It's the thing that stands out. But what we need to move away from is thinking it's not a judge on their character. It's not about the fact they were careless. Sometimes you'll even hear things like they lost their situational awareness, which maybe is a polite form of saying they weren't paying attention. Situational awareness is a real thing, but we can come back to that another time. But we need to think that the error is an outcome of the system that we have designed. It's not a cause. So after the first story, we get down to the second story, and that's where human reliability really takes root. It's about understanding the context of the work, how people are reacting with technology, each other, with procedures and processes. And it's about seeing performance as something that's constantly being managed by them, and they have to make adaptations all the time in real time, often in ways that people don't really understand. And the most powerful mindset shift we are asking people to think about is to understand how things go right. And so I don't really hear people saying they're doing an RCA, a root cause analysis on how things went successfully. So think about the context of the work that people are doing it, and think about how things go right, as well as how did it go wrong this one specific time? Because it may have gone right thousands of times before, in ways that we've no idea about. That's how I'd answer.
That's great. I love that concept of the layered story because that is absolutely so true. Coming back to the article anyway, because that gives me a real idea now of what you mean by human reliability. Coming back to the article that I mentioned in the intro, which was a highly interesting article, well done both. But you opened it by discussing, many uncomfortable signals from the industry, warning letters, recalls, shortages, and while many of those issues are not directly related to human reliability as such, we do seem to have a habit in the industry of making the same mistakes and errors again and again and again. And you argue that the gap is to address that challenge isn't just knowledge, although human factor science is pretty mature out there, but we probably lack a standardized, structured, cross-industry approach in pharma. So maybe I'd ask you first, Dominic, what does good look like in a PQS when human factors are managed? What does it look like when it's working? And maybe what are we doing today that doesn't work? But first question first, what does good look like?
Yeah, okay, thanks, Val. So there's definitely pockets of excellent human factors and HOP work happening in pharma, and indeed we know some of these good people's leading it. But I agree with you, generally, performance is highly variable in this area, and there's little in the way of industry standards, and it's that that we really want to address and start working on. So what does good look like? I think good human factors risk management really means all the organisation's proactively identifying and controlling its critical risks. So they would have got together a list of, however many critical processes they've got, depending on the criticality, the level of human involvement, and the vulnerability to human failure, and actually be attending to that proactively. You'd have human factors integrated throughout the quality system. So looking at design reviews, risk assessments, procedure developments and training programs, in deviations investigations. So leaders would really have a good understanding of their critical processes, that would be top of mind for them. And they'd be systematically working through this, deploying human factors assessment methods, so they can work through that list in order. And this would really lead to better outcomes. There'd be fewer critical deviations. The investigations that would happen would find deeper causes and generate real learning. Teams would be anticipating problems rather than just firefighting them. And there would be time and capability for that important proactive work, not just being in constant reactive mode. Now, I think this really matters for organisations where this is at high stakes. So think like things like CDMOs who are building competitive advantage with their sponsors, maybe even cell and gene therapy companies protecting their investment and preparing to scale. So strong human factors management really provides that sort of extra confidence you're looking for, that human element in the system's being controlled and can deliver reliably when it matters most. But I think to understand more of the gap between that vision and reality, I'll hand over to Julie, who can walk us through some specific examples.
Yes, it's really interesting what you're saying, Dom, because there are some signals that are coming through all the noise in pharma quality management systems that show us that we're not doing things as well as we could. And there are other signals which are frankly lost in the noise and are being managed locally. So I'll just go through a couple of them. One signal you might notice that you've got too many root cause human error, and the RCA, the root cause analysis, stops there. And certainly I've been involved where companies have been had findings, 483s, for example, on that very matter, because what it indicates is that you're not going into the underlying factors. You've stopped being curious, basically, and your RCA stops. Another thing that I've noticed, it's not always noticed in a way by the organization itself, is how siloed we are. So we'll have quality management system, safety management system, training kind of interacts, but often separate. But we're working in silos. We're actually organized in that siloed way, which means when we're creating procedures or trying to make work easier, we're not thinking about safety and quality in the same time. So if you are going to talk to somebody down, let's say in a manufacturing suite, they'll have to get out several documents to tell you the things that the procedures and the instructions that control what they do. So that makes it very hard for them to work in a sort of integrated way. And I think that's a real opportunity. Personally, I've never seen a procedure that includes safety and quality equally. I've seen little pointers for safety, but not integrated. So one thing I'd also like to think about is when we write our SOPs, they're kind of written for when everything goes well, and they never do. So people are always having to make adaptations, be them little tweaks and things like this, tacit knowledge that they've got to make things get over the line, often in ways that are never discussed with them, and the learning for the organization is lost. So the impact of not really understanding the work, as indicated by root cause human error, thinking about working in silos, came directly to Dom and I. We went to a small company. We looked at a very basic autoclave for a sterile manufacturing suite, and they'd been suffering with wet loads for a very long time, couldn't really work out why. So we did a very straightforward human factors analysis with the teams. And what we found was that the procedures, despite all the effort and updates they'd done, weren't actually that clear. They didn't really understand the context of the work. and they were frustrating everybody, and the communications had kind of got lost altogether. So the value of looking ahead and the work that we did took down the risks in this particular autoclave, but then the learning could ripple out across the rest of the company. So if we're continuing to do these kind of things not very well, we're going to just spend more time fixing problems. And I know we don't like to add up how many hours we spend on deviations and kappas, but it's a lot and it's very expensive. So we're looking to create an industry standard for human performance and adopting principles and tools and approaches to enable people to work across the functions of safety, quality, and training. So we'll ask better questions. And when we do that, then our performance and culture will thrive, we hope, even in a more strong way.
So it's about design, really.
Totally.
I think trying to come up with an industry standard, that's a very worthy ambition. And, I think timing might be everything. And this discussion might be very timely because my fear is that the industry hopes that AI and automation is going to solve all this
Yeah,
for them,
I hope so. I'm waiting. Good.
But in your article, you argue that technology alone won't fit human performance problems, and that maybe in some cases it could even make human reliability even worse. So, and I know
Yes.
you're not anti-tech, and that is not your point.
No,
What you're
absolutely not.
saying is it's about designing the system so that humans can interact with them and succeed. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, AI is a new or relatively new kid on the block. We also have, of course, digital. We have automation, also slightly the teenagers on the block. So we're always working with tech. And I was really interested. I heard your podcast in December when Mike Salem was talking about keeping humans in the loop and this
Good
fact that it
episode.
needs to come back to somebody, some person that can understand if we're in the right ballpark or not. So the key takeaway for me at the moment, and it's a changing thing every day, of course, as we learn, is that AI learns so super fast and very capably, but at the moment, it's learning from records of our investigations, our CAPAs, our safety incidents, but they can be quite limited because AI can only rely, talking about the human contribution now, they can only rely on what the words that we've input. Of course, it can go and get data from machinery in the process, but it doesn't often capture the context of the work people are actually doing. So, for
True.
example, if I have to click a drop-down menu, it's classic. It doesn't matter which, even if you're in Taproot, which is the closer you can get to understanding working context. You've got drop-down menus, which means you have to select one or two things that you think are the reason, and AI just believes you and just pulls it out. But they are not AI then can't make the connections and the links to tell the whole story, which is why often in an inspection, someone needs to go in a room and explain the deviation to the regulator. Now, there's a reason for that, isn't there? Because there's something else all around that. So the learning capability is relying on what we write down. Sometimes our CAPAs, from my personal experience and talking with colleagues, our CAPAs aren't great for various reasons, because maybe we don't have enough time or we don't have the priority or the budget. We're not choosing the CAPA that really we want to choose. So we're just putting a little tweak to the SOP, or we're keeping the scope of the CAPA sort of tight. And again, AI can only learn just from that. So this fear of exposing our vulnerabilities and our deviation reports, which we all have with good reason, means that AI is losing this real contextual knowledge and questioning that we're giving to our processes. So what we're suggesting is, of course, AI is great, but the human involvement needs to be really understood and needs to be elevated, because we're changing in a way from being process executors to process monitors now. AI is doing something and it's giving it back to us to review. But do we actually understand the data set that it's gone and had a look at? I think, Dom,
Dominic.
you have some more about AI limitations from your experience, which is different to mine. So that's great that we have this wider picture. Thanks, Dom.
So thanks, Julie. So I think Julie's right about those limitations, and I just wanted to talk to some of the broader design challenge here, which relates to automation in general as well. because human factors has been working in this area for a long time. So it's how humans interact with technology, and that's where automations and AI comes in. So I think definitely automation does solve some problems, absolutely. But it often just moves others, and it can create new ones, which we need to be mindful of. So when you automate parts of the process, you're typically seeing higher demand of human performance go into maintenance, inspection, and testing. So that's how the automation actually works. So there's less sort of manual controls, but there's more emphasis on the maintenance, inspection, and testing of those automated systems. So it doesn't mean that the human performance issues disappear. It just seems to shift and move. So another key question is that we might want to reflect on in this area is how you allocate the functions. If you're designing a system, how do you allocate the functions between the automation, the AI, and the human? And I think what we really want to try and avoid is just trying to automate as much as we can, because that might mean that only the worst bits are left over for the human, that
That's
can't be
true.
automated.
Yeah.
And if we do that, then it's really not the best division of work, and it can actually lead to poorer reliability overall. I think Professor Peter Hancock's got a great quote that captures some of this, at least. And he says, if you build systems where people are rarely required to respond, they will rarely respond when required. So in
Great
other
point.
words, In other words, if you design automation that keeps people really passive until something goes wrong, then you're really setting them up for failure, because when they have that surprise and they have to suddenly take over, you're just not prepared for it. They haven't got that situation awareness, and they're not in a good place. And probably finally, the other thing I wanted to say is, in my experience of doing human factors risk assessments, quite often we it's not just a desktop exercise. We're talking to operators and technicians going out into the working context. And it's really nuanced, some of the things that you'll find that will be affecting the reliability. And it's stuff that the AI system, I don't think at least, would really see. So it might be that a label is beginning to rub off. You're not being able to read that as clear as you once might when the system was new. Maybe it's the glare of a control panel during the winter sun coming off. You see some of this sometimes. Maybe two operators who don't communicate as well as they might because of personality issues and frictions. Even cultural issues may be affecting shift handovers. So these aren't in part of any formal data system, but they absolutely affect the reliability. And we need to be mindful of that, I think. It's definitely the case that, AI is really exciting, and it's got these extraordinary opportunities. But I think people will always still play an essential role. And then where the human factors comes in is trying to design these systems so they can work with the people and not just alongside them.
And Dominic, you mentioned Peter Hancock there, and I remember reading his book a long time ago. I think that's around a while, isn't it? Mind, Machine, and Morality. I found it extremely thought-provoking at the time. So I might give listeners a link to his website as well in the show notes. But anyway, let's continue the thread. This is very, very interesting. I assume we're not the only industry with this challenge. So what do other high reliability industries do that we don't seem to be doing in this space?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And definitely wouldn't feel sort of like left out or anything. You're not behind or anything like that. I think part of the message here is that there's a high degree of variability, and things are changing at the present time. This could be timely for pharma as well. I've worked across several different sectors, and before joining my present company, HRA, I was at University College London doing some research in human factors in healthcare. So mainly looking at medication errors and medical device usability. And at that time, about 15 years ago, human factors was really new to hospitals. Now, since then, there's been a bit of a growing awareness, there's been more training, and the NHS has actually developed its own framework now. So, PSIRF, which stands for the Patient Safety Incident Response Framework, and that integrates human factors thinking into their investigations. This is an example of one industry, where it's been developing over a period of time. If we look at medical device design just on its own, in related but in contrast to healthcare service delivery, now that's had really mature human factors standards for a long time now. They've got ISO standards like 62366 and 14971. Now, this manages gives advice on managing usability and human error as part of the design process, and that has to be done before the devices are accepted and released to market. Aviation and nuclear, they're really strong and a strong history in human factors. Similar with defence, they've got clear standards. In the UK, in the main sector I work in now, COMA, that's the control of major accident hazards. They apply to sites that have potential for major accident hazards from dangerous substances. So this is mainly sort of oil, gas, and chemical plants. But they've had a human factors delivery guide for about 10 to 15 years now. The offshore sector in the UK has recently released a similar guide, but it has slightly different structure. And we're also aware of various regions outside the UK, like Singapore and Brazil, and they're introducing their own human factors standards for oil, gas, and chemical plants. And that's only recently happened, like in the last few years. So I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that safety and quality critical industries are recognising the importance of human factors risks, and they're developing their standards, each with their own sort of flavour and spin, and they're implementing them at various levels of maturity and regulatory oversight. So it's quite a varied landscape, and it is still developing. But it really does beg the question, why don't we have a delivery don't why don't we have delivery guidelines for human performance? So I think there's a real opportunity there, but it's just working out what this would look like for pharma.
Yeah, because I think you make a very strong and compelling argument there. When I asked what are other industries doing, standards, standards, standards came across. And in your article, you argued that the framework you just mentioned, that COMA, which is an unfortunate acronym, isn't it, when you say it out loud, but the control of major accidents hazards, that that particular framework might be useful to pharma. So can you give me a sort of high level outline of the six topics that were you give them in detail in the article now that are in that framework?
Yeah, sure. So, just before doing that, I'll just give some background as to how these came about, because it might seem a bit random why there's six topics. But there was a care review committee a while ago now, but a group of people got together and they reviewed major accident hazards across the sector to see what important issues were happening in terms of human performance. And they identified these common themes and drew them out. There were originally 10, I think, but they've whittled them down to six. So these and the offshore guide I mentioned before, that has a different set of topics. So they're not sort of set in stone, but it's a really nice framework because you've got the six topics to orientate yourself around. And then each one's got success criteria that can be audited against. But anyway, the six topics. So the first topic is managing human performance, and that's really split into two main sections. There's establishing a proactive human factors risk management program, and that might be quite novel from what I understand from some pharma sites. And then there's incorporating human factors into incident investigations. So that's really dealing with both the reactive and proactive learning, and that first topic is really provides the backbone, the spine of the whole framework. The second topic is human factors in design, so it's re really important. So we want to get the design and equipment right that people are working with. So So big things like human factors integration plans for major projects, like where you're looking at the design of sites and things, but also looking at things like control room design, where there's a lot of human interaction going on, and even things like rationalizing alarm systems so they're suitable for human use. You know, it's not really acceptable for someone to be trying to process 40 alarms in a minute or something like that. If they get an alarm flood, you know, you want to work out what alarms are critical and tone down the other ones. And the third topic is critical communications. So things like handovers, permit to work systems, and other points of communication were really important for teamwork and process. The fourth is procedures. Fifth is critical competencies. So ensuring people have the right skills and knowledge to perform critical processes correctly. And the sixth topic is organisational factors. So that might be things like workload studies, staffing, and fatigue management. But as I say, each of those topics has its own success criteria, which the regulators can audit against.
That's so interesting. And very interesting that you mentioned alarms there, because the EU GMPs are currently being up-revved, and Annex 11 is going to say a lot more about responding to alarms, which is exactly what you're talking about there. So this COMA framework sounds very, very close to what we might want to do. There were 10 criteria, they whittled them down to six, and now you're popping back in a seventh, I think, for pharma. Tell me about that.
Well, I think what we thought was that the lens, if you will, that leaders might look at this framework when they're deploying it would be one that includes things about leadership and quality culture and safety culture, because we don't really want to separate the two, to be honest. Because at the end of the day, of course, it's leaders who set the vision, set the tone, and create the time for people to do these things. So we think having a topic seven means it gives them an opportunity to understand what their role is at all levels. And I would say at this point that leaders, we all lead ourselves too. So it's not just about title and seniority, because people listen to what you say, but then they watch what you do. So, as you know, so that's why we felt it was really important to add that in. Here we see the kind of things that I think we'll see in HOP, which we're going to talk about in a minute. We're not trying to add any more complexity or meetings or layers. We're just trying to change up the kind of conversations that we have, thinking about learning teams, having pre and post-job reviews in real time so we can understand how we're getting on in the moment and managing risk. And of course, as you know, ICH Q9 update said it needed to see more of risk management, not risk analysis. So thinking about those kind of questions we can ask about risk. What makes things go right? What is difficult here? What could be confusing? This is building that psychological safety that we hear so much about, but people need to feel confident not only to say what their worries are or concerns, but also to bring forward their ideas. Because the goal here, of course, is all about learning, not blame. So if you're a leader listening today, starting with that curiosity and having this lens, I think will help the six topics come to life for you very meaningfully.
Yeah, well, that's music to my ears, because regular listeners of the pod will know we're big fans of humble curiosity and
Of course.
psychological safety and pre-mortems as well. Just to
Yes.
bring you back to something we've mentioned a couple of times now, HOP, which is getting some traction in pharma. I see it in
Yes.
operation in some of the companies I work with, but some of our listeners might not be familiar with it. So I'll do a quick 411 on what that means. HOP stands for Human and Organizational Performance. So it's a safety philosophy, really. I think it was birthed in the
Yes.
nuclear industry and
Yes.
developed more generally then by Dr. Todd Conklin. And he built on the work of people like Sydney Decker and the Swiss cheese guy, James Reason. And by the way, if you haven't read the books of those guys, there might be a gap in your bookshelf. So I might just compile a nice little reading list and include it in the show notes here, just to give people the full background on where you guys are coming from. But anyway, back to the HOP principles. They focus on building resilient systems by understanding, I suppose, that human error is inevitable. And HOP is based on five core principles. And the idea is, I think, as I understand it, is shifting the focus from blaming individuals to analyzing system weaknesses, learning from failures and improving, and ultimately aiming to design work environments that can, absorb error, in some ways. Now, I know you're both fans of Ted Conklin and HOP, and there are some overlaps with your proposal. But in your view, what's missing if someone only does HOP and doesn't build the kind of, and I think this is an important word, auditable structure you're proposing? A kind of a HOP plus approach is what I'm thinking
Yeah,
you're talking about here.
definitely. Because I think, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have gone to some master classes with Sydney Dekker, so I'm a fully paid up member of the fan
Fan.
club of HOP, and I've used it a lot. I mean, it's very important that people have this open mind, because if you don't have that, then it makes all the learning that more difficult. But the way I would describe it is, HOP looks at people within systems. Whereas human reliability, human factor engineering is looking at the design of systems around people. So I think if you opened up with a HOP learning team and then you needed to go and put in some solutions, I don't think HOP knows how to do that. I think what you need to understand is, oh, it's something about the way that I've got seven screens on a packaging line. Now, human factor engineering will tell you how you can make that easier to do, rather than run up and down the line trying to control the printer, the check weigher, all made by different companies with different formats. So if you've ever seen that kind of scenario where people are trying to control a lot of things, so I think it's really understanding you've got the HOP mindset and culture, and then you've got the systematic human factor engineering. So then you've got really a really important combination. And if I may, I'll just share very briefly my personal story, because this is why it makes sense to me. So way back in 2009, I was in production in pharma, and we had a serious issue in the way something had manually been put together, two bits of plastic with an O-ring in the middle, and we lost an important batch because the O-ring wasn't seated correctly and shredded through the batch. Now, I always considered myself a listening leader, so my first reaction, I really wasn't blaming the people at all. It was just worry, really, concern. I said to the team, "Well, just walk me through, because it's kind of in the back of the production area. It's not where you go normally. You can't just stroll in." And then what I saw that day, really changed my perspective. And personally, I felt thoroughly ashamed that I didn't understand how impossible it was for them. But this learning has stayed with me. I mean, I'm even getting, like, I'm going red in the face now, because I remember it was a real emotional reaction. I had no idea what was happening. So they were carrying this burden of all the system failures, really, and had been for ages with no problem, but not really understanding. So that was a turning point. I started to look with the help of colleagues and supervisors, but there was nothing in pharma that could tell me what to do. So I went to safety. I went to the health and safety exec, used their material and training. And over time, I learned about HOP, of course. And then I realized, yes, but there's HOP and there's human reliability, human factor engineering. So if HOP's focusing on understanding how organizational systems and culture support people and how the organization learns, then human factor engineering is slightly more technical. It's more rigorous. It can be audited about the systems that we design around people. So you, in my opinion, from my personal journey, you need both. HOP gives you so much, but then it kind of leaves you with these questions that I believe human reliability and human performance, that like we're suggesting here, can give you answers to. And I think that's more
Dominic,
where Dom is more in that
you've some
area
thoughts here. See you
than
nodding
me.
enthusiastically.
Yeah.
Well, I think the first thing to say, I'm not aware of sort of like a definitive scope about like what one covers and what does one doesn't, and there's a large degree of overlap. And probably offering our perspectives is going to resonate with a lot of people, and maybe others would disagree. So it's a bit of a contentious area. But there is nuance, and I think there's definite differences as well. I think from my perspective, he's right. HOP has done brilliant work in building psychological safety and getting leaders
Yes, huge.
engaged with those frontline realities. So I think it's definitely heavily focused on activating leaders and getting them out on the Gemba, talking to staff, responding to what they learn about when you know about how work is actually done. I think human factors engineering, which is sort of more of the philosophy behind the COMA approach and what we do in the safety context, it is more systematic and engineering focused and very much on those critical processes. So not necessarily like things that you might find out about when you're doing your walk on the Gemba, that are top of mind for people and just irritating. These might be hidden critical risks that might only be found like through a focused workshop and using certain systematic methodologies. So I was trying to think of an example, and if we imagine that we might have an issue with the process, I think a hop learning team might be convened that brings people together. They would, I think, map the process, brainstorm improvements, and it's really good for that engagement and organizational learning. I think in contrast, and also similarly, because at some level these are, you know, the same things, but from a human factors engineering perspective, so we wouldn't call it a hop learning team. It'd be more something like a safety critical task analysis approach. And rather than mapping the process, we would do a step-by-step analysis, maybe using hierarchical task analysis. So really going into a lot of detail. We would then apply failure modes to try and predict human errors that could potentially occur that haven't happened yet. Now, some of these would be critical, some not. Not all errors are equal, whatever we might say. And then use performance influencing factors to see what is driving the likelihood of these potential errors. So what makes them more likely, what makes them less likely. So there's a lot of conceptual work going on there and systematicity and detail that I don't think you get from a hop learning team. But at some level, you know, they're doing similar things. They're getting a multidisciplinary group together. They're focused on a problem. They're analysing it and then trying to get some insights out of it. So I think in terms of key differences, I think you know, learning teams definitely excels at getting people together, understanding and problem solving. I think the human factors engineering is more systematic. Maybe helps you anticipate and prevent problems that you haven't experienced yet and they're not top of mind, and really ensure nothing critical gets missed. So there's definitely something there about risk and criticality in high stakes processes. But I
Definitely.
think in the end they are complementary. Like I wouldn't want to try and set up a fight between them,
Oh, no.
and we whether one's better than the other. I think HOP really, you know, builds that foundational culture about people speaking openly about problems. But I think also we would get a lot from the human factors engineering side, bringing that more structured analytical toolkit for those sort of deeper problems. But they probably have a, you know, much more in common than they have differences. I mean, definitely thinking about those five principles, they both subscribe to those.
You know, as kind of somebody so involved in risk management, that predictive element is very attractive in what you're saying in that human factors engineering. So, yeah, lots to think about there. Listen, to come back to your article, because it was essentially a call to action, and you outlined actions for both regulators and manufacturers. So, you know, with that in mind, and, you know, thinking that, you know, you're here to engage people in this concept. You know, what's the next sensible step for this initiative, and who's best placed to initiate it?
So I think in the long term, I think maybe an industry collective involving manufacturers and regulators should probably own this. You know, this is much too big for sort of like a small group of people, you know, to take forward. And I think other sectors have, you know, done development work to develop their own frameworks in such a way. But the pre-work we need before we get to that. We can't just wait for that infrastructure to emerge. Julie and I have been thinking about, and we're actually working on this now, and want to bring people together that are interested in this area and have those early conversations about shaping things and taking this forward. So in terms of a next step, we're establishing a community of practice, and we really want to bring together quality professionals, human factors experts, any forward-thinking organisations to collectively define what good looks like. So what should a pharma human factors delivery guide look like? What do the success criteria, what should they look like? Which ones can we adapt from pre-existing frameworks like in coma? Which new ones do we have to introduce? Because you really want to make this practical and not theoretical. So we're inviting companies, industry groups, and regulators to join this conversation. So if you're interested, do connect with us on LinkedIn or complete the expression of interest form. Now we've designed one, and hopefully it's okay to put a link to that in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. And because this is really about collaboration, and we're not here to dictate a framework. I think we've got like the spark and the roots here, and it's really to grow something, but together we're working with other people, so we can learn from colleagues in high hazard industries. But pharma needs to develop something that really works for its own unique challenges. And so I think one of the questions is whether any of the listeners out there want to be part of shaping that future with us.
And Julie?
I think just a call out to the key stakeholders are manufacturers and regulators. So for manufacturers, I would say you can really start now. I mean, if you're not or building on what you're already doing, just by thinking what are your most critical risks in your processes. I know we have critical to quality parameters and critical quality attributes, but in your process, if you walk down on the floor and said to people, what are the critical risks? I wonder what they would answer. So if you could start to think maybe one of those, and then we could start to think about how we could understand to make that work easier. And for regulators, I mean, you're already there in the space of medical devices. So asking questions like, is this process re really usable, as you would ask about a medical device? And as I said, where are the critical human error risks? So as a regulator, I'm coming in to understand the landscape and the lie of the land in this facility. Where are the critical risks? If a coma regulator goes in, he asks or she asks that question, and they get out their lists. They've literally got their critical risks. I don't know if we really have that in pharma. So I'm not saying we have to do that. It's just something we could think about. So we could start doing it proactively now, just to start to understand the opportunity for proactive risk management, because this is answering the call from ICHQ9. I really believe that.
There's definitely so much that needs to be done and can be done, and you're certainly calling out some great first steps there. But I'm a big fan of what can we do on Monday. So if I was a head of quality or a QA manager or a production manager or just an ordinary folk listening, what's the first move I could make in the right direction here that doesn't require a big reorg or a budget, or is there anything we can do to sort of nudge things along?
Well, if I could go first before passing over to Julie, but I think in terms of further learning, I hope people forgive me for just a bit of a shameless plug for our own blogs that we have on Human Reliability Associates. I've also developed a free mini course. It's only 30 minutes, and it's on human factors critical task review. So part of the process that we use in this type of work for proactive risk assessment, so people can Google that. And then an actual case study. Julie referred before about the autoclave prepping case study. So we have presented results of that in a webinar, and that's attached to the blog. So it brings to life a bit. What can be done if people are looking at these sorts of things. But there's also great resources, for example, from the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics and Human Factors. They've got a website and lots of free learning material. If people have been interested in this area, they can find out a bit more there. But I think Julie's got some more practical tips on the could be done on the shop floor.
I think, yes, I just think I would say, and again, this is learning from some of our high hazard colleagues, is if you're out there doing an organisation walk, you might call it a Gemba walk, change up your questions a bit, perhaps, because what we're trying to do is put ourselves in people's shoes, step into their world. So asking people to talk you through what they're doing in this process, a bit like when you're doing a driving test, advanced driving. You have to not only, of course, drive, you need to explain what your thinking is while you're doing it. Ask them, what do people find confusing or difficult? And what helps this go right? And how do the SOPs help you? Normally, I'm laughing because normally that's what happens when you ask people that. How do the SOPs help you? They normally just laugh. So you can take from that what you will. So for anyone, please try that. For heads of quality, I would ask you to think about your dashboards. Don't just celebrate the green. Ask the team, how easy was that green to achieve? In the place I worked for many years, we took on the thinking that, is it watermelon green, meaning green on the outside, but if you scratch it, it's red underneath. So Todd Conklin says, embrace the red, question the green. And I think this is a great philosophy to think about when you're looking at those dashboards. I know there's massive, massive pressure to have green dashboards for your site, especially when you're in a league table and you don't want to be at the bottom. So, yes, question the green would be a really good next step for Monday.
Well, that's wonderful advice. And actually, both of you, a very thought-provoking chat. And I will share all the links that you've mentioned and the little library of books that maybe people could dip
Great.
into as well. I think if anyone is listening and who wants to get involved in your COP or just learn more, we will share the links. We will share the form you mentioned in the show notes so people can reach out to you. And it would be a wonderful thing to even birth on this podcast, that
Oh, it would be
community of
great.
practice. It would be brilliant. Yeah. So thank you
Absolutely.
both for taking the time to join me and for all the work you're doing, which is coming out of pure passion and generosity, by the way. I'd like the listeners to know this is not a sales pitch. You're not selling a product. You're just floating an idea, a well thought out, well birthed idea, and looking for that engagement and feedback from like-minded folks in the industry, or even maybe not like-minded, because I think sometimes challenges can make our ideas stronger. So that's good
Definitely.
too. So
Definitely.
thanks for that, and that's the call to action, folks. So thanks, Dom. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you so much, Valerie. Thank you.
Yeah,
Thanks,
thank
Dom.
you.
Wow. Well, that was such a rich conversation. I absolutely loved it. And of course, so many of their touch points were so familiar to what we talk about here on Risk Revolution regularly. And I'm glad that you kept they kept pulling you back to that core idea of human reliability isn't about fixing the people, it's about designing for people. And for me, one of the quotes that they used I loved is, it's seeing performance as something that is constantly being managed in real time. So it's constantly changing and shifting. And depending on what crew we're on or who's involved that day, it's constantly changing. And yet, when we write our SOPs or our work instructions, we write them as if it's a complete static environment. Do this, then do that. It's a sequence of events. And we're not taking into the fact that on any given day with any given crew, it's an actual dynamic environment that's happening and they're adapting at all times. So I love that. That was a big takeaway. And that, of course, the move from reactive to proactive. If your system only learns after you lose the batch or after a significant deviation, you're paying for that learning in your most expensive currency. I think they termed it as we wait for the incident to happen before we dig in. So again, very much aligned with the thinking around proactive risk management that we've regularly spoken about. But their emphasis on structured task analysis and performance influencing factors felt like a missing piece of our jigsaw for our PQSs. Like they say, we do the root cause analysis of all the things that went wrong instead of actually looking at what's working well and how we can continue to improve it or ensure that it works well right every time. I also really like the way they talked about normal work. We don't need to study failure. We also need to study the success. Otherwise, we're only getting half of that story. So I loved that. And speaking of stories, I loved the fact that they spoke about capturing the knowledge, and more to the point, the tacit knowledge from those successes. So again, that leans back into some of the other guests we've had on the podcast, around the whole area of managing knowledge and particularly managing that know-how that's in the organization and within our teams. And so because that frontline is constantly compensating for the design gaps, because we haven't designed the system for the people, that compensation can be a gift or a warning, as they say. So it's a gift because they keep things going and we keep getting, getting through, muddling through the day. But it can be a warning, because it also can hide that fragility. We don't know those know-how steps are not written down, they're not designed in, and they're happening by accident sometimes rather than by design. So I particularly that really spoke to me. I also picked up on that idea of the layered stories that you mentioned, the first story, second story. And the first story is obviously the narrative around the deviation or the error or the slip or miss, whatever has happened, the misstep. But it's the second story that they are interested in. What was the context? What was the workload? What were the handovers like? How many alarms were happening? Competing goals, ambiguity, staff fatigue, all the stuff that gets done every day and interferes with our ability to get work done and, and get our best work done. So it did remind me, as you mentioned as well, about that great conversation in the recent episode with Mike Salem on AI and about keeping the human in the loop, which he was very strong on. And again, you could see Julie and Dom were really building on that today. And if you design people's where design systems where people are rarely required to respond, then they rarely respond well when they are required. That Peter Hancock, I mean, that really rang true for me, and again, with the concept of all this AI coming in and all the technology coming in, that we're almost making our operators passive. So then when something does go wrong, how on earth are they going to know how to respond well, particularly if we haven't engaged them in that design process? So I am, in that context of AI and digitalization, I really found what they were saying to be so true. And before I finish on this, the other element that in one of her closing points that Julie made to you was, if you go and speak to anybody on the, within the design team or on the shop floor, they'll be able to tell you what their critical quality attributes are or their critical aspects are. But if you ask them what their critical risks are, they wouldn't have a list. Whereas in the other safety critical industries that Dom has been talking about, they have a list. They're immediately able to refer to their list of where the critical risks are. And that comes back to something we regularly talk about, Val, is around the risk communication. There's so much emphasis on the risk assessments where we identify what those critical risks are and we quantify them and all the rest that we do with them. And then then they go into a black hole. We certainly don't put them up on the wall or in the SOP or for the operators or the frontline analysts who are using the systems. They're supposed to somehow by osmosis interpret the batch manufacturing record or the test method to identify where those risks are, because we don't clearly say, pay attention here, this is a critical risk, and we're asking you to do this in the following sequence because, and explaining the why. So I hope I'm certainly going to be signing myself up on the expression of interest. I'd love to get involved in this framework that they're talking about building out. I'd also love to invite our good colleague of the pod, Dr. Marty Lippa, who's a knowledge management expert around his expertise on extracting and, you know, curating tacit knowledge and asking the right questions, as Julie said, you know, asking different questions in order to gain that knowledge. So I'm looking forward to getting involved, and I hope that whatever framework emerges from this, I think it's going to close a lot of gaps that we already know are there in the risk and quality space, where we assume things are getting done and they're just not. So Val, tell us more about this call to action.
Absolutely. And you're so right there with what you say, Nuala, that link between human reliability and knowledge management. You know, yeah, I'm starting to see things coming together, and I love when a plan comes together like that. Mm. So I hope people will get the same inspiration from that original article as we did. So I'm going to share that in the show notes so everybody can read it. And, you know, Julie and Dom also shared a wealth of resources, including free access to a mini course on human factors. So I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. And I think I mentioned during the interview, I might put a little reading list together, because we did refer to a lot of folks and their writing, and the work that Julie and Dom are doing is built on the work of several great thinkers. So I might share that on the Risk Revolution LinkedIn page, because I think I'm going to run out of room in the show notes. But most importantly, and I'll share this in both places, I'll share Julie and Dom's contact details for anyone who wants to get involved in the broader conversation and in this community of practice that they're trying to build. And I would encourage anyone who's listening with an interest on the topic, or who has concerns within their own organization, or anyone rolling out HOP, because I think their slightly HOP plus version is more enabled for pharma. And look, just anyone who's looking to sharpen their management or supervisory skills, you know, get involved. And just like you, I'm going to get involved myself, because I think too often, you know, we both see that risk control depends on human reliability. And I know that there are many tools out there to design those factors more robustly. So I see a very strong connection with risk management and with decision making. We talk a lot in our industry about best practice, but I'm not sure we've developed a toolkit to establish what exactly that means at a task level. You know, we assume that if everybody follows the procedure, that'll be good enough. But, you know, people and behaviour and culture, it's not a maths problem. It's not a mechanical problem. It won't be resolved by a score on an FMEA. I think when we rely on our humans, when we rely on humans on the loop as a risk detector or a risk control, I think it's important to look more closely at what that means. So, yeah, encouraging everybody to join this conversation, contribute to the future, and all the links are in the show notes, folks.
Yeah, brilliant. Closing thoughts. Well, I guess that's a wrap for another Risk Revolution episode. I hope we have revolutionized some of your thinking around human factors and human reliability. As usual, we'll be back each month on a range of topics with a mix of guests and interviews and conversations and our regular book club episodes. So please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so all our new episodes will miraculously make their way into your feed. We have remind you to that we have set up a LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page, so please do join us there and feel free to message us with your thoughts or any ideas. But for this month, it's a goodbye from me, Nuala,
and bye from Val.